Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Hold Fast, a novel by J. H. Galerenter. Read by John Lee. Chapter 1. May the 13th, 1803. London. In a dark oak-panelled room on the second floor of the Admiralty House, Sir Edward Banks tapped his fingers and waited to be asked to speak. He had an unpleasant duty to discharge, and he wanted to get it done with. It had been judged appropriate, he supposed, that His Majesty's Office of the Admiralty and Marine Affairs be lined with the same oak that built His Majesty's ships. With the war sure to resume, Sir Edward had no doubt that the peace negotiated at Amiens would be brief. He wondered if England might come to regret spending oak on anything besides hulls and planking. He let his gaze wander to the window and out to Whitehall. Such questions were not for his deliberation. He did not sit on the Navy Board. His name was not on the captain's list. He had never been, nor would he ever be, gazetted. He was the chief of naval intelligence, and thus outside the regular hierarchy. "Sir Edward," said the First Lord, "you had some business concerning Malta."
"Yes, Lord Vincent," said Banks,
"but only to report that we've had to recall our man there, and will for a short time have to rely on the conventional channels."
"Wasn't that Captain Thomas Gray?"
said a vice-admiral of the Blue, speaking for the Mediterranean squadron.
"Yes."
"There is no Thomas Gray on the captain's list, sir,"
said the Lord Surveyor. "Captain Gray was formerly a captain of the Marines, sir," answered the admiral, "and a very solid man, I'd thought. Indeed, Admiral, he has, however, had some difficulties of a personal nature. The gentleman's wife was killed a year ago, March." There was a brief pause, during which Sir Edward hoped, vainly, he knew, that his colleagues would permit him to leave the matter there. He strongly preferred not to add to Captain Gray's troubles by trespassing on his privacy. However, though needless to say it was not uncommon for an English gentleman to be a widower, for his wife to have been killed was most uncommon indeed. As the matter related to work done for His Majesty's Secret Intelligence, the Admiralty Board would require further detail. The asking was left to the First Lord.
"Killed, Sir Edward," said John Jervis, Earl of St. Vincent.
"Yes, my lord, sometime in the early winter of the year one, an American ship called the Agnes ran aground on the west coast of North Africa. The American crew were taken captive by Sawari tribesmen, who worked and beat them near to death, before finally bringing the three surviving men, of an original 14, to the slave market at Mogador. They were purchased by a local potentate, who believed them to be English, who attempted to ransom them back to us. He sent word to our station at Malta, upon which Admiral Godfrey dispatched Captain Gray to secure the hostages' release. Captain Gray had been stationed in Malta for 3 years and, as you know, engineered most successfully our intelligence network in the Adriatic and on the Dalmatian coast. Because of his experience working in those areas with the Turks and Turkish vassals, Godfrey concluded, rightly, I'm sure, that Gray was the best man for the job of dealing with the Barbary Pashas. His wife was a keen naturalist, had had a paper read at the Royal Society in 99, and persuaded Gray to allow her to make the trip with him in hopes of a visit to the Atlas Mountains. In the event, she made her trip, and he secured both the release of the Americans and an invitation for an English embassy to Mogador. The invitation, I make no doubt, you gentlemen will recall." Several members murmured their agreement. "During his return to Malta, the 14-gun brig which carried Gray and his wife, along with the Americans, Constance, I believe, was the vessel's name, was encountered and pursued by the French frigate Fidèle, 32. This was before Amiens, of course. A stern chase ensued. Before a fresh wind took her aback, the Frenchman was able to close within extreme range of her bow chasers. On a rise, Constance was raked at her waterline. Mrs. Gray was then in the cockpit, nursing the emaciated and feverish sailors her husband had rescued. The splinters killed her. It was a bad death. She was the brig's only casualty. In the subsequent months,
Captain Grey attempted to resume his duties, but was judged by Admiral Godfrey to be unable, or at least not reliably able, owing... Sir Edward referred now to a letter on the table in front of him. To profound and unshakable melancholia. Godfrey expressed his hopes that Grey's condition would be attended to in England. I arranged to have him seen on Harley Street, but he wrote yesterday from Portsmouth to say he has returned instead to his house in Kent at Sheerness. I intend to see him there tomorrow. Admiral Lord St. Vincent nodded to Sir Edward, who looked around the table to see if anyone else had any questions. The Admiral of the Blue cleared his throat.
How long before we have a replacement in Malta?
We will have a new man in place there by the end of the month. I am informed that he passed the Nor yesterday, answered Sir Edward. But he continued, The question, though, will we be able to replace Thomas Grey, remains very much up in the air. Chapter 2 Thomas Grey sat in the gardens of his estate, Marsh Downs, surrounded by an assortment of flowering rhododendrons whose specific names he'd never bothered to learn. Now, of course, he never would. They'd been planted by his wife. 200 or 300 yards away, the tide was beginning to turn. The waves breaking on the reedy end of his marsh were beginning to push inward, and soon the birds who stalked the mudflats, looking for worms and snails, would fly inland. He had planned to take one or two for dinner. A shotgun rested across his lap, and his Irish setter, Fred, rested at his feet. Grey was glad, and frankly somewhat surprised, that the dog remembered him, since Fred had spent the last several years, most of his adult life, as the companion of the Downs' gamekeeper, Canfield. Fred seemed sensible of something being wrong. Dogs always are. From time to time he nuzzled Grey's foot, and Grey reached down to scratch his head and neck. The fact was, Grey didn't feel much like shooting anything. Fred would be disappointed, but it couldn't be helped. A walk might answer for an acceptable substitute. Anyway, his housekeeper, Mrs. Hubble, who Grey believed had now recovered from the shock of his unexpected return, had, no doubt, something in mind for him to eat. It wouldn't do to insult her with a fresh kill. He stood up, and Fred stood up with him, wearing a keen, gun-ready look. "Sorry, my boy, not today. Maybe tomorrow." Grey took a final deep breath of the flowers and began a slow walk back towards the house, wondering how Canfield had mustered the will to keep the garden so neat around an empty house, with no expectation of anyone but himself and Mrs. Hubble seeing them. Before leaving for Malta, thought Grey, he should have opened the gardens to the neighbourhood. What a waste were 3 years of dead blooms that no one had enjoyed. As he walked south, the house rose up over the gardens. It wasn't especially large, but it was, Grey had always thought, unusually striking. Its almost pink brick exterior topped off by a copper roof, tarnished to a beautiful verdigris, set off by creeping, darker yellow-green ivy. He'd bought it with his share of the prize money from a small French fleet captured by his intelligence in 98. 98 was the year he'd been married, his marriage being the reason he'd given up his house in town and moved to a country estate. He'd worried that he'd find himself unable to resume living at the Downs, alone. In fact, being back was the one thing that had given him any comfort. He and Paulette had had no children. Thank God there were no children to worry about. Grey stamped some sand off his feet and stepped into the small stone-floored mudroom, where he left his coat on a hook and his gun on a table. He opened the door into the larder and paused, hearing three voices in the hall beyond, a woman and two men. He reached back into the mudroom and picked the shotgun up again. Grey crossed through the larder and into his foyer with the gun dangling from his right hand, adopting as casual an expression as he could. Following at his heels, Fred seemed pleased that perhaps shooting hadn't been stricken from the agenda after all. Mrs. Hubble was standing in the doorway, speaking to Canfield and another man, who was just beyond Grey's line of sight. The voice was slightly lower than he remembered. Too much smoking, no doubt. Equally, though, there was no doubt that it belonged to Edward Banks. Now, Sir Edward Banks, benighted since the beginning of Grey's Mediterranean posting. Grey leaned the shotgun against a clock and interrupted the conversation which was evidently a moot to determine where he might be. "Sir Edward, please come in," he said, adding, "Thank you, Canfield. And, Mrs. Hubble, would you fix us some coffee, or," to Banks, "would you prefer tea?"
"Coffee would suit me very well, thank you," said Banks, crossing the threshold.
"Mrs. Hubble, perhaps you'd bring it to us in my study."
Banks followed Gray down the hall and into a medium-sized room lined on all sides with glass-fronted bookcases. Banks had been in the room several times before. He wondered if the shelves were fronted with glass as a defence against the rich salt air that was filling his lungs and making him, in spite of himself, feel 10 years younger. His mind continued to wander. He wondered if he shouldn't move to the shore, as Gray had. Of course, Gray was 25 years his junior, and had been married, which Banks was not, and had never been. The thought of marriage snapped him suddenly back to the matter at hand. Gray had paused in front of a black ocean's globe. He gave it a gentle spin, turned, and gestured to a deep button leather chair.
"Please to be seated, Sir Edward. I confess I wasn't expecting you."
"Weren't you?" said Banks. "I should have thought being sent to London and stopping 40 miles short would invite both comment and company."
"For my part," said Gray, "I understood that I was being sent home. Haven't you heard? I'm melancholic."
There was a knock on the door.
"Come in, Mrs. Hubble," said Gray.
The housekeeper stepped into the room, felt the unease in it, set the coffee on Gray's desk, and left again, without a word, closing the door behind her. The interlude gave Gray just time enough to feel ashamed at his insolence towards a man to whom he owed so much, whom he admired so deeply.
"I apologize, Sir Edward. Please, sit.
How will you take your coffee?"
"Black," said Banks, remaining on his feet.
He accepted a cup, took a sip, and finally lowered himself into the chair. His face showed no trace of anger. If anything, thought Gray, the unfurled forehead and the slight narrowing of Banks's blue-gray eyes suggested the conversation was proceeding more or less as he'd expected it to.
"I left word at Portsmouth that Dr. Welsh was expecting you at his practice on Harley Street this afternoon. Did you receive the message?"
"I did, sir."
"I won't embarrass you by repeating my sympathies. The service must know what sort of condition you're in if you're to be of any use to us."
Gray nodded.
"I gathered from Admiral Godfrey that you intend to remain in the service."
This time Gray made no response.
"Do you?"
"I had thought so, sir," said Gray.
"But you don't any more."
"To tell you the truth, sir," said Gray, "I'm not entirely certain what good I'll be."
"To determine what good you'll be is precisely the reason I've arranged for you to see Welsh."
Banks put down his empty cup.
"I will expect to hear that he's looked you over by Friday at the latest. Now, I must get on to Chatham and the yards. My horses are still in the harness."
He stood and continued.
"As I say, by the end of the week, I'll be back at Admiralty House. If you'll excuse me, I'll show myself out."
Gray waited through 2 loud ticks of his foyer clock to answer.
"Yes, sir."
At the door, Banks paused, turned around and spoke in a momentarily paternal voice.
"Look, Tom," he said, "it's no good letting the clouds hang on you forever. Impious stubbornness, Shakespeare called it."
The official tone resumed.
"There's work yet to be done. War is on the horizon. I will expect you on Friday."
Banks opened the door and left it open. He retrieved his hat and coat without waiting to be helped, and a moment later Gray heard Banks's man starting the horses. As Sir Edward's carriage pulled away, Gray poured himself another cup of coffee and took a seat behind his desk. Chapter 3. Early the next morning, Wednesday, Gray presented himself at Dr. Welsh's office, only to discover that the doctor was not yet in. Was not in the habit of arriving at his office before 9, and would the gentleman care to wait? Gray declined, and said he would return. Perhaps, he thought, after a turn in Regent's Park, which was 100 yards north. As Gray walked out of Welsh's practice, he wondered that he should be up and about before the esteemed doctor. His picture of a physician, as opposed to the naval surgeons with whom he was much better acquainted, was of an abstemious, scientific gentleman prone to burning the candle at both ends. Of course, to be fair,
These days Grey was barely sleeping, which had made it easier to post in from Kent before dawn. It was the first time Grey had been in London in 3 years. He'd become used to Maltese weather, and the fresh spring morning felt chilly to him. He watched a farmer's wagon rattle by, leafy heads of vegetables hanging over the tops of wooden crates. A servant on an early morning errand flagged it down. Other servants passed Grey on the sidewalk, attending to other early morning errands before their masters woke, mixing with tradesmen and shopkeepers on their ways to work. A cat had decided to lie down on a sun-warmed paving stone by the gutter. Grey picked it up before someone could kick it and carried it the last few yards to Regent's Park, where it promptly went to sleep, resting against the warm iron of the park's fence. There was a waist-high granite and brass sundial just inside Regent's Park's southwestern entrance. Grey looked at it and then narrowed his eyes to look at the sun, unconsciously preferring his own judgment of the sun's progress, a preference not unusual among men who've spent long stretches at sea. It would be at least an hour and a half before the doctor made his appearance. Finding his patience worn unexpectedly thin, Grey retraced his steps from Harley Street and continued on towards Mayfair and his man of business, the other man Grey wanted to speak to. But here was another man not yet at work. Was the whole city asleep? Certainly there was enough bustle about. After the countryside and a few years in the Mediterranean, Grey found London distractingly loud. Perhaps that was the source of the impatience he felt nipping at his heels. At his office, Grey was informed that Mr. Pater was not in, but, said a junior associate, he could probably be found at his club, where Grey knew he often slept. Pater, that lazy son of a bitch, damn his eyes, thought Grey to himself, offering the associate his polite thanks. Should the gentleman like a chaise called for him? No, said Grey. He would walk. It wasn't far. Anyway, he didn't add, there was no sense seeing an old friend whilst in a mood to take his head off. A walk would give him a chance to reflect on Pater's virtues, such as they were. Buttles, halfway down St. James's Street, was just far enough for him to remember what one or two of those virtues were. Though Pater was, in fact, a lazy son of a bitch, whose eyes more than a few acquaintances had damned, he had never stolen any of his clients' money, and through some rather canny investments had taken the modest sum of prize money Grey had won as a marine captain and turned it into a respectable, if by no means immense, private fortune. In a man of business, he supposed, these were the virtues that mattered most. Pater's sometimes residence, Buttles, was one of the older gentlemen's clubs, of the several dozen that were now clustered in London's West End. Its brick facade, buttressed by two pairs of Michelangelesque pilasters, was set slightly back from the street, behind a stone railing and a low hedge. As Grey stepped through the club's front door, into a navy-blue room with cream-coloured mouldings, he wondered how Buttles contrived always to smell so clean and inviting, so close to the mud and muck of street. Was there a dedicated perfumist crouching behind the desk? Was there a ship's company of youngsters fanning fresh air in from some secret cloister? "Good morning, Mr. Grey. It's a pleasure to have you back with us," said Mathers, the porter. Grey hid his surprise that Mathers should know his face. It had been years since Grey's last visit to the club, and even when he'd lived in London, he had never been a frequent guest. He was not a member. "Mathers," said Grey, "the pleasure's mine, I'm sure. Is Mr. Pater in?" "He is, sir," said Mathers, signalling to a page who was waiting in the wings, who now crossed a series of small oriental rugs that led to Mathers's station. "Parslow," said Mathers, "show Mr. Grey into the lounge." The lounge was a dark, wood-panelled and candle-lit room, where maroon curtains covered windows that had long since been bricked up and panelled over to ensure privacy from the street. Grey had expected to find Pater at his breakfast. In fact, he was deep in a game of whist, with coffee at one elbow and a dram of whisky at the other. The grizzle on his chin suggested this was not an early morning game, but a hangover from the night before. Pater noticed nothing until Parslow bent low behind him and spoke a few words into his ear. When he looked up and saw Grey, his mouth fell open. He dropped his cards and stood, to the grunted annoyance of his partner.
"Grey, dear heart, what a damn surprise to see you," said Pater, with an open, affectionate look on his face.
His countenance quickly changed as his memories caught up with his surprise.
"Tom, I was so damn sorry to hear about Paulette. Those effing French bastards."
He offered his hand, which Grey shook, and then took Grey's elbow and pulled him towards the table, pointing to each of the other three men in turn. Langley, Slayton, Brummel, Grey. Polite nods from each and from Grey in return.
"Have you had your breakfast?"
asked Pater, stroking his unshaved cheek and stifling a yawn.
"I say, it's damned early to be out and about. Is the sun up?"
"It is," said Grey, smiling in spite of himself, "and has been for some time already."
"But you haven't eaten?"
"I haven't."
"Marvellous. Please to go into the dining room and order something to start. Parsley will take you, and I'll be with you in a few short tricks, in a few shakes of a lamb's tail."
In the event, the wait was somewhat longer than that. Grey sipped coffee, wasn't hungry, stared absent-mindedly at an etching of a Roman ruin that hung on the dining room's forest-green walls. But the delay did give him time to make his mind up about a notion that had been with him since Kent. Since Malta, in fact. And Pater was the man he needed to discuss it with. Perhaps the doctor's absence was a stroke of fate. Not that Grey believed in such things, he reminded himself. When the man of business finally sat down, he noticed the absence of any breakfast dish in Grey's vicinity, looked abashed, and waved over the steward.
"You haven't begun? I hope you weren't waiting on my account. You'll forgive me, I hope, Tom. I couldn't abandon my post during so warm an action."
"Ah, here," he said, as the steward took his place at Pater's left hand.
"Order anything you like. I mean, you remember how it works here, I dare say. Tell the stewards anything you can think of, and if it's to be had in London, the kitchen'll have it bought and made for you in a trice, before the starters and maybe a tot of rum are disposed of."
"Just a roll and butter and some more coffee, thank you."
"Very well, though I find your lack of imagination worrying.
Oscars, bring me some bacon, scones, some of that currant jam, and some of those peaches, if they're still on hand. Bring Mr. Grey one as well. Maybe he'll change his mind. But they're very fine fruit, Tom, you'll see. And Oscar's a pot of the strongest tea that's ever been brewed this side Tiber."
The steward nodded and backed away, and Pater adopted a more serious expression. "Now, Thomas, to what do I owe this meeting? As glad as I would be for a purely social call, I'm afraid you must have something more substantial on your mind."
"Yes, I have. I intend to sell Marsh Downs, or rather, I intend you to sell it." Pater nodded.
"Lovely place, the Downs. We'll be sorry to see it go, but I do understand. It shouldn't take long to sell. You know I've had several rather brash, unsolicited inquiries about it over the last few years. Such a perfect spot between the sea and London. Should get a good price for it." "Yes, a handsome price. I suppose you'll be looking for a new house in the city, to buy or to let?
Of course, I can put you up here at the club while I have a look around. A mint of pleasant places have come on the market, and now that peace has broken out and the hangers-on are moving back to the counties. Will you be bringing Mrs. Hubble with you? I imagine Canfield will go with the estate. Shame, though, I shall miss his advice on shot and powder. But do tell me what sort of accommodations you have in mind."
"No, not London," said Grey, letting Pater take a breath.
"You may recall, my mother was from Boston."
"In Lincolnshire?"
"No," said Grey, "the other one, in the United States. A relation in America has considerable interests in lumber. I've long had a standing offer from him to return there and take a position in his firm. I've decided to accept."
"Return? Thomas, were you born in America? Forgive me for being personal."
Grey shook his head once to show Pater no apology was needed. "That, in fact, was a subject of some debate between my parents. My mother says I was born in Boston. My father says, having been born aboard a king's ship in Boston Harbour, I was on English territory from the first. In any case, it was before the war." The food arrived, and the two men were silent as the steward laid it out.
"But Tom, damn it, you can't be serious," said Pater. "You intend to go into retirement as, what?
I don't know what the term is. A lumberman? A lumbermonger? At your age?"
"Of course," he added quickly, though without conviction, "that's none of my business."
"A lumbermonger,
said Grey. "You don't like the ring of that?" "No, but I'm quite serious. A change is as good as a rest, and I imagine the more drastic the change, the better. I'd like a line of credit against the house. I see no reason to wait for the sale. Arrange a stipend for Canfield and Mrs. Hubble to keep them until they've found new positions, and the rest in a letter I can draw on in Boston." Pater took a moment to pour himself a cup of tea and word his response.
"I'll do just as you say, Tom, never fear. But should you be making so great a change so soon after so great a bereavement, can you possibly be thinking straight? It's awfully goddamned hot in the summers there, I suppose you know, and cold as Lapland in the winter, and business is not at all like a position in the Foreign Office."
The Foreign Office being the employment Grey pretended in public.
"And after being abroad, mustn't London and England be all the change you need?
I say again that it's entirely your own affair,
but if it were in my power to compel you to wait, I'd say take a week, take some advice, speak to someone in your confidence."
Grey ate his roll and nodded politely. But on Thursday morning, when Sir Edward Banks arrived at his office, sat down at his desk and began to look through the overnight correspondence, there was a letter from Thomas Grey. He looked it over, then called in his chief of staff.
"Willis, this letter from Grey."
"I haven't looked at it, sir. It was marked personal, for your eyes only."
Banks slid the letter across his desk.
"Read it."
"To the Honourable Sir Edward Banks, etc.,"
read the chief of staff aloud,
"regarding our meeting of Tuesday last, I hereby tender and hope you will accept my resignation forthwith from His Majesty's Secret Service."
Chapter 4. Was Fred Canfield's dog or Grey's? Grey had to concede it would be cruel to rip the dog from his home in Sheerness and ship him to the New World, especially having been with him again for just a few days after a 3-year absence. But it was with great reluctance that he gave the dog what he assumed would be a final scratch behind the ears. Then there was a firm handshake with Canfield himself, a tearful embrace from Mrs. Hubble, who made Grey promise to write, and then Grey embarked in a 4-in-hand coach for Portsmouth, with enough luggage to tide him over, the rest to be shipped by Pater once Grey had a permanent address in Massachusetts. The carriage ride took most of the morning, southwest through sunken lanes that had been worn into the earth by 2,000 years of traffic and made tunnel-like by canopies of thick mid-spring leaves. By mid-afternoon, Grey was on a bum boat being rowed out through Portsmouth Harbour, one of dozens ferrying officers, sailors and passengers among the ranks of merchantmen and men of war that stood at anchor, waiting on tides and schedules and orders to depart. He followed his dunnage up the side of the West Indiaman Ruby, not as sleek or as graceful as a modern man of war, but in its way a very attractive thing. She was a stout, solid ship, displacing perhaps 600 tons. Simple black and white paintwork beneath 3 masts and 10 or 1,200 square feet of still furled canvas. Most of her cargo appeared already to have been loaded, and most of her crew must have been in the hold, ensuring that everything was squared away. The men who remained on deck seemed chiefly preoccupied with questions of the bowsprit and foremast rigging. 2 others were lashing down a coop of chickens who would be coming along on the voyage west. On the quarterdeck, at the binnacle, a pair of officers were talking with each other, alternately gesturing down at the compass and up at yards. Neither was the captain. Grey introduced himself to each, shook hands, and was shown below decks. His cabin was a small but not unpleasant room amidships, directly beneath the waist, with a gun port for a window, a luxury unknown in the service, where all but the forward and aftmost of the gun deck bulkheads were permanently struck. His chests arrived a moment behind him, and after some cursory unpacking, just some ink he wanted to ensure hadn't spilled, and a book he intended tucking into in short order, Grey stuck his head out the gunport and surveyed the scene. Despite having formally left the Royal Marines upon his recruitment to the Secret Intelligence Service some years earlier, before Earl St. Vincent had christened them Royal Marines, in fact, when red-coated, sea-going soldiers were still part of a semi-formal detachment from the army, a part of His Majesty's Marine Forces, Grey's mind was wandering. Despite having left uniformed service years earlier, today he had considered wearing his uniform. Because, despite its being peacetime, there was a hot press on, the hottest in years.
The country was at peace, but the Admiralty refused to believe it. Men who would normally...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?